tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I'm your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 30 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. And today we're speaking with Tim Crum. Tim is a nationally recognized expert on fundraising, board governance, and shelter operations in the animal shelter industry, who is often called upon to speak at national and regional conferences and has presented more than 300 times. In 2008, Tim founded Animal Shelter Fundraising and has consulted with more than 300 animal welfare groups across the United States and has raised in excess of $400 million. In 2013, Tim co-founded Animal Shelter Services to help animal shelters and rescue groups with operational issues ranging from shelter evaluations to board development to interim management. His companies are a four-time award-winning company. Tim, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So before we dive in deep and how you can help us all become better organizations and do more for the cats that we've got out there, how did you become so passionate about cats?
Great question. And the backstory is, I think, a little bit unique and interesting. So I was raised a dog person, raised with small breeds, Shih Tzus. And I had always been a dog person, even through college. And then I dated a gal who was a cat person. And I was exposed to cats and I fell in love with her cat. And because of that experience, my household then went from becoming a dog household to a dog and a cat household. So I've had cats and dogs now. In fact, my most recent cat, her name is Two Socks, named after the wolf in the movie Dances with Wolves. You may recall, he named the wolf, I believe it was Two Socks in that movie, because of its distinctive markings. So I have a cat that has two white paws. And when I saw her, I thought instantly, that looks like Two Socks. So yeah, I've been a dog and a cat person.
Wonderful. Tell me a little bit about your journey. I mean, how did you get to founding Animal Shelter Fundraising in 2008? Did you volunteer with a group? Did you go to school for fundraising or nonprofit management? I mean, how did you get to that position?
Yeah, great question. And it's a million-dollar question, so I'll give you the condensed version. Actually, my undergraduate degree is in architecture with a minor in studio arts. So my college education was not putting me on the trajectory to work with animals. But in college, I worked for the University of Pittsburgh as a telemarketer in their fundraising department and found out I had a talent for that. So once I graduated from college, I actually pursued a career in the development / fundraising field. I was working for colleges and higher education. An opportunity arose for me at the Animal Rescue League of Pittsburgh, which is where I was born and raised. And that began my career in the animal sheltering industry. And after spending time at the executive level for three different animal shelters, I decided it was time to form my own company and take my experiences, my skills, and my knowledge to help others within this space to do what they do even better. So it was an interesting trajectory to get where I am, but I'm glad it brought me to where I am today because I love what I do. And they say, when you love what you do, you never work a day in your life, which I find to be true.
So I have a degree in urban planning. I was in urban studies, and then I went to get a master's in urban planning. Originally, I wanted to be an architect, and I did some design work and worked for a couple architectural firms for many years. So it's an interesting thing that you say, because there are a lot of people in this field that have design in their background, whether it's arts or architecture or interior design or research, the social research. I think people gravitate towards this sort of strategic thinking and wanting to apply it to impact a better world for our animals. So there are a lot of us out there, Tim. It's not just you and me.
Right. And I think that's important for your listeners. If you're currently in another field it's not too late to transition into the animal sheltering industry. I did it. You did it. I know of so many others. In fact, the head of the Petco Foundation, she was an attorney at first, and now she's the head of Petco Foundation. So just where you are now isn't where you will always be. That should be helpful to those who may be listening today. Maybe you're in the retail space or you're in the food industry. Wherever you are, if you have a passion for cats, dogs, rabbits, horses, you can take that experience and make the transition into our field. And our field would welcome people like that.
Oh, definitely. So you started out in fundraising. And I would say, too, when I was running the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, I was spending 80% of my time on fundraising and then the 20% on programs. We had a director of operations at that point in time, and I really entrusted her with our day-to-day programs, the hands-on issues with the cats and managing the staff. And I was really responsible for doing a lot of the fundraising. And it developed a lot of incredible relationships with people. So many of our TNR organizations, they're small, and they're, I will say, some of our folks are kind of shy. Fundraising, people think you have to be a salesperson to be able to raise money. I created relationships and friendships with people to tell them about what was going on. But I would love to know what your successful tips are with regards to fundraising if you're brand new to the concept of actually asking people for money.
I think the fundraising field and the animal sheltering field can at times be at odds with one another. And I'm painting in very broad strokes right now, because for the most part, as a fundraiser, fundraisers tend to be very social beings, very outgoing. They have the ability to create conversation and keep conversations going, and they could acclimate into any social situation. That's what makes fundraisers so good. Within our industry, the animal sheltering industry, we have a lot of people that are extremely passionate about animals, but they may not be very adept with their social skills. And that creates a dilemma, because people within the animal sheltering industry, they want to help pets. They want to help the cats and the dogs and the rabbits. But when it comes time to fundraising, they tend to shy away from it because that skill set isn't necessarily the skill set that they have. That's why the experience I've had as a fundraiser is typically when animal shelters, especially if they're small groups, like less than $1 million, less than $500,000, they tend to gravitate towards grant writing. And the reason for that is you could sit behind a computer, you could research a grant, you could write a grant, you could submit a grant and never have to speak with somebody and maybe have that rejection of, we didn't accept your grant. Whereas with fundraising, if you're asking for money, that could be difficult for somebody to sit across the table or go to lunch or have coffee with a prospective donor and have to ask them for a $10,000 or $25,000 gift, or even $500. And to have to face the fear of rejection is difficult. So I have found in my time within this space that there is a bit of a conflict, that our industry tends to adopt or attract people that are very good at caring for animals and have a big heart, but they tend to shy away from those social things. And even if you go to some of our national conferences, you will even see T-shirts that say things like, I love cats. People, not so much. And so I think even though we joke about it, there is truth in that our industry tends to attract that. Now, what I could say is probably over the past 5, 6, 7 years, I have seen a shift in our industry where we're bringing people from other industries in. You know, you and I are good examples of that, planning and architecture, and now we're in this space. And we're seeing more of that, people coming from other professions into this. And I think that's good for us to be able to see that. But it still is a dilemma that exists with a lot of shelters, especially the smaller ones that are formed to help a certain mission, say to help cats, but they really don't have that sense of, well, how do we raise funds? We know how to care for the cats. We just don't know how to raise the funds. And that creates that dilemma.
Yeah. And talking about the people within the organization, and I'll now spring forward to some of the larger groups that you work with through your animal shelter services. So you founded that business in 2013. We're now almost 12 years along. And I feel like there's been an incredible staff rotation in that period of time of changing of staff, compensation, as well as the veterinary shortage, the technician shortage. But I also think that there are probably other positions where there have been shortages. I think many organizations still have positions that are available that are not filled, and organizations are working at like 2/3 of their staff capacity. Are you feeling these types of pressures with the clients that you serve?
I feel them all the time. So my company, Animal Shelter Services, we do shelter evaluations where we come in and we spend time on site examining all aspects of operations, from animal care to the volunteer program to the vet medical to the management to staffing. We look at things like capacity for care, and we do see those dilemmas that are playing out. One of them, of course, is the veterinarian shortage, which is, I feel like it's been 2 years now. I know that we were hired to do a recruitment. This was in the state of Maryland for a veterinarian. It took 11 months. Now, normally when we get hired to do like an executive recruitment like that for an executive director or a veterinarian or like a CFO or something, 4 or 5 months is usually a long time. But with this vet shortage, that took 11 months. It was painful for both sides because I was exploring avenues I never explored before to try to recruit, and it was just difficult. The other problem that I think we will always have within this industry is the pay. The pay is low for entry level, and the conditions aren't always the greatest. You go to work and you come home and you tend to smell like animal waste. And after a while, you do become immune to that. So you may not even smell it, but that does get onto your clothes. So that makes it difficult when you're not receiving the best pay in an entry-level position. You're working under those types of conditions where you're cleaning up animal waste. You're dealing with, in most cases, life and death situations on a daily basis. And then there are customer service issues. You know, dealing with the public is not always easy. So it's very challenging in the animal sheltering industry, particularly in keeping people at entry-level positions, which are typically animal care workers who there's not much movement upwards other than maybe go to shelter supervisor, shelter manager, which is a great position, but shelters typically will employ 5, 10, 20, 30 animal care workers. So it's very difficult and it's challenging for them.
Helping kittens thrive takes heart and the right skills. That's why the Online Kitten Conference is here to support you with 2 days of expert-led sessions, June 7th and 8th, from 10 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you're fostering bottle babies or working in a shelter or a dedicated kitten caregiver, you'll walk away with new tools, ideas, and inspiration to make an even bigger difference. This is a fully virtual event, so you can tune in from anywhere, and registration includes access to the recordings, slides, and handouts. Register by May 8th, and you'll get the early bird rate, just $50 for the full event. After that, it goes up to $75, so don't wait. Head to communitycatspodcast.com/kittens and reserve your spot today. What if a conversation could save a cat's home and prevent them from the trauma of a shelter stay? As a surrender prevention specialist, your words can make all the difference. Join Dr. Rachel Geller on May 14th from 2 to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time for a live session on the most effective behavior solutions to prevent unnecessary surrenders. You'll learn how to help struggling cat owners overcome challenges like litter box problems, scratching, and aggression. You'll earn a digital certificate after passing the certification quiz, get 3 additional behavior modules to watch after the webinar, access to session recordings, extensive handouts, and exclusive networking opportunities. Spots are limited. Register now for the Surrender Prevention Certification Workshop. It's just $10 at communitycatspodcast.com/keepthecat. That's communitycatspodcast.com/keepthecat.
Want an easy grant opportunity for your animal organization? Maddie's Fund is giving away a $3,000 grant each month to one lucky Maddie's Pet Forum member. You'll automatically be entered to win each month when you start a new discussion, reply to a new post, or upload a new library resource. Learn more at forum.maddiesfund.org today.
What happens to cats when disaster strikes? The Lahaina wildfire left behind hundreds of surviving cats, but thanks to a coordinated rescue effort, many were saved. Now the experts behind that response are sharing their insights, from on-the-ground rescues to reunification and placement. On May 13th, from 1 to 6:15 p.m. Eastern Time, join those who are on the ground in Maui for a vital discussion on disaster preparedness for cats. Learn how to rescue and find outcomes for cats in crisis and how you can prepare your own community. Sign up now at communitycatspodcast.com/recover because no cat should be left behind.
One of the things that I've become aware of recently is working on these job comparison charts. And so now you'll have a range of what the hourly pay is for each position. And you're not just looking at like an animal caregiver position as your competition, but you also want to look at in the for-profit sector, what might be your competition for that position for that person. So what would the skills of this person, would they work at a Target or a Whole Foods or something else? Are you comparing yourself against that type of competition to hire? Because I do feel like in this day and age, a job is a job. People have to pay their rent. Housing affordability is really challenging. And as much as we all want to work for the animals and help them, we also have to pay the light bill too.
Right.
And I do think that is a little bit stronger. So our competition for filling these positions, we have to look at it a little bit differently. So those comps aren't necessarily just in that nonprofit space.
Right. And we actually do those type of comps when we're looking at animal shelters. So we just completed one in Georgia and one in Texas, where we're looking at what are the other entry-level positions that people would enter into this particular region. And so we're looking at Walmart stockers. We're looking at Target customer service reps. We're looking at local grocery stores or McDonald's and Taco Bell. And what I've been finding is that the pay is improving in the animal sheltering space, but it's still, when you're comparing it to, would I rather work at Walmart or Target, not have to deal with some of the issues we deal with within our space, then actually that does become a bit more attractive. And unfortunately, in our space, I just did a shelter evaluation in Georgia. And in talking with a lot of their animal care workers, these are people that are working two jobs. So after they get done with their 8 to 10 hour shift at the shelter, I spoke with quite a few guys that were had to get on a bus for an hour to go to another part-time job as a security officer or working at a Walmart as a stocker. So it makes it so challenging for our industry when a person can't even survive on one income, they have to work two. And then there's other issues. A lot of those guys that I spoke with, they're single dads and they have kids and they have to arrange with a friend or a family member to have their kids picked up. So a lot of challenges for us to have to cope with in our industry.
So as you're doing your shelter evaluations, what are you seeing with regards to community cats and how the shelters are dealing with them? Are they doing TNR days? Are there traps? Are there rooms? What are you seeing sort of in your scope for helping community cats?
I think a lot of shelters are utilizing TNR programs and trap programs. I would safely say maybe 80 to 90% of what I've seen are dealing with that. I think the ones that are being able to move the needle the most are the ones that have shifted more towards animal intake diversion programs. So I think for decades, the animal sheltering industry was focused on what do we do with the population we have within the shelter and how do we get it out the doors? And I think there's been a shift over the past 5, maybe 10 years where we're not only looking at what can we get in the building out, but how do we prevent them from even coming into us in the first place? So I think the cat groups and even the animal shelters that are having the most success are the ones that are dealing with intake diversion programs. They're being able to prevent those cats from coming in the door in the first place. Because as you and I know and our listeners know, cats, for the most part, respond very poorly in the shelter environment. And I actually have felt for years now, having done so many shelter evaluations, I do feel like we need some type of paradigm shift in how we're housing animals within, or housing cats within this shelter. Stainless steel cages, they're not, I don't see them as working. Yes, they're great if you're housing a cat for 3, 4, 5 days, but when you're talking over a week, and a lot of the shelters, when I do their evals, we're talking cats that are in their system for 1, 2, 3, 4 months or greater. They respond poorly. That is not a great space for them. We have other issues like URI, which runs rampant. One thing I'll share with listeners, or if you happen to work in an animal shelter, is staff tends to play really loud music to benefit themselves. And they're doing it in animal housing areas. And I can't tell you the number of evaluations I've done where I walk into a room and I have a sound reader and it tells me in decibels what the readings are. And I'm getting readings 90, 100, 110 decibels from the music. And a cat room is typically 40 to 60 decibels on any given day without music. You add that element of music and that stresses the cats out. So I know the staff thinks, oh, this is great. I get to listen to top 40 music while I'm working. It makes my day go by quicker. It is problematic for the cats and they don't respond well to that. So yeah, for all of those issues, animal shelters are just not the best space for cats.
Yeah. And for years at the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, rather than talking about how do we keep the cats out of the shelter, it's more of a question of what is it that the family needs to support that cat. And so I sort of try and always turn the conversation outward and just saying, okay, here you have this cat. Let's evaluate what the situation is. What is it that we can do to help support you to be successful with this cat? Whether it's a cat they've picked up in the backyard, do they have to put a paper collar on that cat and see if somebody owns that cat? If it's an injured cat, I mean, it's trying to evaluate the situation holistically rather than saying, I have to be defensive here. And like, we have these walls. And I think sometimes organizations have a hard time of communicating when they put up a defensive wall, communicating that they really are trying to help the community at large. Because they're trying to say, oh, we're just trying to prevent cats from coming in. But the reality is we're trying to do the best thing for the cats and for those that are caring for those cats. So I think there's a lot of communication out there that can help, because I know there is stress out there in the community right now in the animal welfare space about putting friendlies back outside. And when do you make decisions as to whether a cat goes out or not? And I don't necessarily think that's the shelter's decision. That may be more of the neighborhood's decision, mm-hmm. and having communication in the neighborhood and understanding what's going on out in the neighborhood. It's not our choice, but that's my own opinion, which is I feel like to create a self-sustaining animal welfare space, the community needs to be empowered to support those cats and dogs in the community as a whole. And then we're just servicing by providing resources.
Yeah. And we've seen some programs that work rather successfully in how they're marketed, sometimes called a barn cat program. I know other places call it a working cats program. And I think it's a marketing ploy, I think. It's a great twist on maybe getting some harder to adopt cats out into those environments where they could do what comes natural to them. The downside to that, of course, when you have cats outdoors, is they could be hit by a car. And sadly, I actually just witnessed it just 2 days ago, taking my son to his high school. We had just missed, but a cat was hit by a car. And that was somebody's own cat. And that's sad because they probably allowed it to roam free outside. So there's a drawback to those programs. But I do think barn cats and working cat programs are definitely a good way to help get cats out of the shelter environment and into an environment where they're more comfortable.
Right. And I find it very interesting too, and I've mentioned this before, the listeners know that I spend part of my year in Switzerland, and there nobody has litter boxes for their cats. They all have cat doors and the cats go outside. And yes, cats are hit by cars, but they are just more of the mindset that it's just the way that cats need to be. And I know in the States, it's much more of an indoor only focus with regards to our cats. However, in a study that was done with stray cats that were brought in. They put a collar on them. When they put them back out, 80% of those cats had some sort of a connection with a person. And so if you took 100% of those cats and 80% of them really had somebody who had involvement with them. And so then maybe it's because they're not spayed or neutered that they're not coming into the house, right? I mean, I don't want an unneutered male cat in my house. So maybe it's we focus on getting all the cats spayed, neutered, and then our community absorbs them. I've certainly taken cats in from my backyard that I've made sure nobody else owns. It may start with spay, neuter sort of as the base to helping our cats, and obviously ensures those kittens aren't going to be born out there too. So I guess I'm going to circle back before we close out and just talk about our veterinary shortage and the lack of access to spay, neuter across the country. And how is that, in your opinion, really hindering our successes?
I think it puts us back into the position we were, say, in the 80s and 90s, where we were having a problem with overpopulation. So we're getting back to that problem again. And then when you have an overpopulation, that means euthanasia rates at shelters go up. It means length of stay could be reduced drastically because you're having this constant turnover. So a cat that may normally stay in the system for, say, 4 weeks to have a chance, maybe in a particular shelter, it only has 5 days before it's turned over simply because of space. So I do feel that that is impacting what's happening at the shelter level because we need more TNR programs so we could keep cats in the community without having to bring them into the sheltering system.
When you do your shelter evaluations, are you also evaluating spay-neuter clinics that serve the public too, or are you just focusing on the animal adoption side of things?
So we focus on everything that that particular animal shelter does. So as you could imagine, some shelters offer a lot of different programs from full-scale, low-cost spay-neuter clinics where they do private surgeries as well, to we do some animal shelters that have no medical component to them at all. So basically, we're looking at, in the context of the environment they work in, how are they doing?
Excellent. All right. I think this is a fascinating conversation. We could talk so much longer because I haven't even touched upon the word board of directors, right?
Right. That's another subject altogether that we could easily fill the time with that subject matter. Love to talk about that too.
So we'll have to have a part two, I think, to this conversation.
I would love that.
If folks are interested in finding out more about the work that you do, your services, the programs, how would they do that?
So the two easiest ways is to access us online. One is animalshelterfundraising.com if it's for funding. And the other is animalshelterservices.com if it's for shelter operations or board governance or shelter evaluations. And we also have a website, animalshelterevaluations.com, if people are interested in that space.
And Tim, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
The only other thing I'd like to share is that I have written a children's book. So if anyone in your audience has somebody who is learning to read for the first time, I have a book that is available at timcrum.com. It's only $10. It's great because it teaches kids how to read, how to count, and it uses animals, which is based on my experiences and my travels around the world. So something that I've contributed to help people out.
Wonderful. Excellent. Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us today here at the Community Cats Podcast. I really appreciate you agreeing to be a guest on the show, and I can't wait to have you on in the future. We will talk about those board of directors.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.